TV off and hurries back to the kitchen, where Kate is unpacking her cooking implements, and Exalta is sitting at the table with a gin and tonic in front of her and her checkbook out. Mr. Crimmins always hands Exalta a stack of bills from the local contractors on her arrival.
"There's a TV in the den," Jesse announces.
Exalta looks up.
"What?"
"Mother," Kate says. Jesse realizes she should have known better. It took her grandmother years to agree to the Magnavox, and she has resisted updating to a more modern hi-fi, despite Kirby and Tiger constantly imploring her to do so. There was no way Exalta would have sanctioned a television set. This is Jesse's mother's doing. A tremendous quarrel ensues.
"Get it out," Exalta says.
"I will do no such thing. David and I paid for it."
"I should hope so," Exalta says, "but nevertheless, this is my house. My house, Catherine, and I want it out."
"I'm sorry, Mother. I realize I should have asked, but I thought you'd say no."
"Of course I would say no. I am saying no. No!
I absolutely have to watch Walter Cronkite," Kate says. "I'm sorry, Mother, but Tiger is my son. He's so far away, and the only way I can know what's going on over there is by watching the evening news."
"Darling," Exalta says.
She pauses to throw back the rest of her drink, and when she speaks again, her tone of voice is a degree softer.
"If there's anything to know, they'll tell you."
"That's cold, Mother."
"But true. Unless we hear otherwise, we can rest assured he's alive. I don't see how watching Walter Cronkite is going to do anything but make you worry. And the names they come up with for these battles, my goodness, Hamburger Hill, it turns the stomach.
I need the television for my peace of mind."
"I'm sorry, darling. I'm going to ask Bill to take it back to wherever he got it. You should never have gone behind my back. I'm a grown woman, Mother. The television is staying.
If you're interested in a test of wills," Exalta says, "you've chosen the wrong opponent."
"If the TV goes, I go," Kate says.
"You can't be serious.
Try me."
Jesse wonders if she's going to have her wish granted so easily. Will Kate leave Nantucket and take Jesse with her? She has never seen her mother and grandmother argue. Usually, Exalta states her wishes and everyone else bends over backward to accommodate her. Jesse knows they did have a battle when Kate announced she was marrying David Levin, but that was about true love versus religious bias. This is about a television set. Kate must feel more passionately about the news broadcast than Jesse realized. She knows her parents watch Walter Cronkite every weeknight, but the same basic information can be found in the Boston Globe. And as far as television news goes, Jesse has to side with her grandmother. She finds it gruesome. She doesn't want to hear the body count every night. Before Tiger left, it was just a number. Now, Jesse realizes, each body in that count was a person with a name and a family, and talents and quirks and likes and dislikes. She also realizes that if Tiger dies, he will shrink to a number, one more body among tens of thousands. Jesse can't listen to Kate and Exalta another second. She slips out the back door to the cool, fresh air of the yard. The yard is composed of a brick patio and a small plot of grass. Along the grass is a flagstone walk that leads to the property's second dwelling, known as Little Fair, which fronts Plum Lane. Little Fair is where Blair, Kirby, and Tiger stay. Upstairs, there are two bedrooms, one bathroom, and a small living space with a galley kitchen. Downstairs, there's a third bedroom and a half bath. Around the side of Little Fair is an enclosed outdoor shower. According to Exalta, there is no reason to shower indoors during the summer. So although there are three full baths in the main house and a bathroom with a stall shower in this house, Exalta insists that everyone in residence at All's Fair and Little Fair line up for the outdoor shower. Jesse decides to check on things at Little Fair. She's 13 years old,
and she knows that her siblings stayed by themselves in Little Fair as teenagers, but somehow she doubts she will ever be allowed to make the move to Little Fair. She might be able to use it as a clubhouse, however, a quiet place to read and escape the tensions across the yard. As Jessie pulls open the screen door, the groan of the door is as familiar to her as her own voice. She wonders why Kate didn't think to hide the TV in Little Fair. Exalta never comes over here. The inside of Little Fair smells like bacon. Bacon, she thinks. Has someone been cooking in here? Jessie's stomach growls. She peers in the downstairs bedroom that used to belong to Tiger. The bed is unmade, and there's a copy of The Godfather on the nightstand. Jessie's eyes flick to the closet. There are clothes inside. A man's clothes. What? Jessie suddenly feels like Goldilocks. She tiptoes up the stairs, because now she hears a noise, a repetitive thwack, and then a softly uttered curse word. Damn. Hello? Jessie calls out. She pokes her head between the spindles of the railing and sees a boy, probably 2 or 3 years older than she is, lounging on the couch with one of those paddles with a ball attached by a rubber string. The boy wears only a pair of mustard-yellow bathing trunks, a choker of what looks like wampum beads, and a white rope bracelet. He sits up. Oh, hi. You're Jessie, I bet. The boy is tan already, and his hair has a glint of gold that Jessie knows can only be achieved by swimming in salt water and letting your hair dry in the sun. At least, that's Kirby's claim. Jessie's hair is dark brown, and dark brown it remains all summer long. The boy's rope bracelet is fairly new, Jessie notes. It's still bone white and loose on his wrist. Jessie has forgotten about rope bracelets. At the start of each summer, she and Kirby and Tiger would walk to the Seven Seas gift shop, and each of them would pick out a brand new clean white rope bracelet that would then shrink and weather with every swim. By the end of summer, the bracelet would be dingy gray and snug around Jessie's wrist. But somehow Kate would wiggle the blade of the scissors between rope and skin to cut the bracelet off before they returned to Brookline. Who are you? Jessie asks. Pickford Crimmins, the boy says. Call me Pick. Pick, Jessie says. Are you related to Mr. Crimmins, then? I'm his grandson. Grandson? Jessie didn't know Mr. Crimmins even had a child, much less a grandchild. I'm Jessie, she says. Jessie Levin. I know, Pick says. Bill told me about you. You call your grandfather Bill? Jessie calls her grandmother Exalta in her mind only. If she ever called Nani Exalta to her face, she would be stuffed into the buttery for all eternity. That's what he asked me to call him, Pick says. I met him for the first time at the beginning of May. You just met your grandfather? Jessie says. Pick tosses aside his paddle game, gets up off the couch, and stands at the top of the stairs, where Jessie can get a better look at him. Pick is tall and lean, and cute, Jessie decides. Very cute. Cuter than any boy at school, but that only serves to make her self-conscious. She loses her wits for a second, then regains them. What is he doing here? What are you doing here? She asks. Making lunch, he says. Bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches on toasted Portuguese bread that Bill got from this place called Amy's Bakery. You ever heard of it? Portuguese bread from Amy's, another summer tradition that Jessie has forgotten about. Portuguese bread is a dense white that makes the world's best toast. Some people buy 20 loaves at the end of the summer, take them home, stick them in the freezer, and enjoy the bread all year. But Exalta and Kate think this is cheating. Portuguese bread, like tomatoes and corn from the farm stand on Hummock Pond Road, is meant to be enjoyed only in the summer. Of course I've heard of it, Jessie says. They make chicken pies on Thursdays and brick oven beans on Saturdays. Good to know, Pick says. So, can I fix you a sandwich? Yes, please, Jessie says. She's confused and a little uneasy about what Pick is doing in Little Fair, but her hunger wins out. She sees at least a pound of bacon, crispy and brown, draining on a paper bag. There are two tomatoes and a head of iceberg lettuce on a cutting board, the one that Tiger scorched with a pot long ago. Want mayo? Pick asks. Yes, please, Jessie says. She sits down at one of the seats at the table for three and wonders what her siblings would think if they could see this stranger in the kitchen at Little Fair. Technically, he's not a stranger, Jessie supposes. He's Mr. Crimmins' grandson, and they have known Mr. Crimmins all their lives. But do Blair, Kirby, and Tiger know that Mr. Crimmins has a grandchild? Pick said he only just met Mr. Crimmins in May. What does that mean? Jessie has questions, but she's temporarily mesmerized by the sight of Pick creating the sandwiches. He toasts the precious bread until it's golden brown, spreads it with mayonnaise, layers on the bacon and sliced tomato, then tops it with lettuce that he shreds expertly with the dull chef's knife that has probably been at Little Fair longer than Jessie has been alive. He puts the sandwiches on plates and gets down two glasses from the cabinet. He knows where everything is in this kitchen. How is that possible? He brings a frosty pitcher of lemonade out of the icebox, delivers both sandwiches and drinks to the table, and then reaches into the narrow closet that serves as a pantry and produces a cylindrical tin of Jay's potato chips. Jessie's mouth drops open. Potato chips are expressly forbidden in both houses. The only time Kate allows Jessie to have potato chips is with her chicken salad sandwich at the club, and even then, if Exalta happens to be present, Jessie has to ask for carrot sticks instead. An entire tin of potato chips here, at Little Fair. Pick raises his glass of lemonade to Jessie. Nice to meet you, he says. Jessie stares at him. He has arresting ice blue eyes, the color of the rarest pieces of sea glass. Okay, she says. They touch glasses, and Jessie feels embarrassed. She has never touched glasses with a boy before. She has never eaten a meal alone with any boy except for Tiger. When she finishes half her sandwich and a large handful of chips, it's taking all her willpower not to devour the entire canister in a frenzy. She says, "Are you living here?" "I am," he says, "and my grandfather is living in the room downstairs." Jessie is so shocked by this news that she is temporarily speechless. Pick snaps his fingers in front of her face. "Earth to Jessie." Jessie can't help herself. She smiles at him. "I'm here," she says. June 16th, 1969. Dear Tiger, thank you for the birthday wishes. I got a record album and two necklaces, but the best present was the letter from you. There was no cake this year because we drove to Nantucket, but after fried shrimp at Susie's snack bar, we walked to the Island Dairy Bar and I got a hot fudge sundae. There are two things I have to report. One is that Mom and Dad bought a television set, and Mom asked Mr. Crimmins to put it in the den at All's Fair without telling Nani. Mr. Crimmins sends his best, by the way, but more about him in a minute. Mom and Nani had a fight where they raised their voices and Mom threatened to go back to Brookline. I left the house before the end of the fight, but guess what? The TV stayed. Mom later told me that the way she convinced Nani to keep it was to tell her that, for the first time ever, Wimbledon is going to be shown on television in the United States, so Nani will get to see her true love, Rod Laver, play. Jessie stops to think about the time Kirby called Rod Laver Red Hot Laver right to Exalta's face, and how Exalta had thrown her head back and laughed. Tiger had been there to witness it as well, and later they agreed that Kirby could get away with anything. Exalta had always had quite an affinity for Rod the Rocket Laver. Kirby had off-color fun with the nickname as well, and it intensified after Gramps died. Her mother had been smart to bring him up in her battle to keep the TV. The other thing I have to tell you is that Mr. Crimmins will be spending the summer living in Little Fair with his grandson, whose name is Pickford Crimmins, but who goes by Pick. Pick is 15 years old, and he used to live in California with his mother, whose real name is Lorraine, but who goes by Lavender. Lavender is Mr. Crimmins' daughter, but she left Nantucket when she found out she was pregnant. Pick says they lived in towns all over California, including, for the past 5 years, in a commune near a pear orchard. But one morning, Lavender decided she wanted to do some traveling, so she just up and left without Pick. Someone else at the commune knew how to contact Mr. Crimmins, so he drove out to California in his old truck and brought Pick back to Nantucket. Now, Pick has a kitchen job at the North Shore restaurant. He works the salad station, but he hopes to get promoted to the hotline over the course of the summer. He worked in the kitchen at the commune, which is where he learned to cook. The commune was vegetarian, so Pick hadn't had any meat ever in his life until the ride back from California with Mr. Crimmins when they stopped at McDonald's. Now Pick loves meat. His favorite is bacon, and I told him that was your favorite, too. Jessie pauses and reads through the letter. She wonders if she has talked too much about Pick. Will Tiger be able to tell that she has a crush on Pick? She never understood the term crush before, but now it makes sense because every cell in Jessie's body feels like it's being squeezed. Her heart is like an orange pressed into the knuckle of the juicer until all of the emotion oozes out. I start my tennis lessons tomorrow morning. I would say I'm dreading it, but I know you are facing a lot worse things than 2 hours on hot clay smacking balls over a net. I miss you, Tiger. Please stay safe. Love, Messy. Magic Carpet Ride. Kirby is the last girl to arrive at the house on Narragansett Avenue for the summer, Evan O'Rourke informs her. Evan is Alice O'Rourke's bachelor nephew, a balding 40-year-old with a paunch who's wearing white shirt sleeves, brown pants, and brown Oxford loafers despite the June heat. Kirby is still smarting from her interaction with Dr. Fraser. She has been replaying the conversation again and again, trying to interpret Dr. Fraser's facial expression and tone of voice. Do your parents know about this? Dr. Fraser had asked Kirby the exact same question the first time they met. Evan tells Kirby that he lives in the basement apartment of the house and manages things for his Aunt Alice, who is almost completely deaf and has cataracts. Kirby decides it might not be a bad idea to give Evan a glimpse of her charming side. Well, your aunt certainly is lucky to have you. Evan turns scarlet. He follows Kirby up 2 flights of stairs, which allows him to glimpse more than just Kirby's charm, and she can see that this job probably affords Evan all the excitement he can handle. By the time they reach the attic room, he's flushed. You're in luck, he says. The girl who was living here didn't like being on a floor by herself, so she moved down to the room that was supposed to be yours, which is the size of a telephone booth. So now you get this room, which has a double bed, and your own sink. It's grand, Kirby announces. The attic room is, as one might expect, spacious and dusty. The sides of the room slant with the roof, but there is still sufficient space for a double bed, a dresser, a wardrobe, a standing fan whose steel blades create a welcome breeze, and the promised sink with a tiny round mirror nailed above it. There's also one window that looks like it opens onto a lower portion of the roof. Magnificent. I love it, Kirby says. Evan sets down her big suitcase, and Kirby puts down her duffel and places her prized possession, a portable silver-tone record player, on the bed. My father has paid the rent, correct? Correct, Evan says. You also get breakfast every day except for Sunday. The shower and toilet are on the second floor, shared by 3 other girls. Women, Kirby says. Are you a feminist, then? Evan asks. Suddenly, he looks intrigued. Maybe he's wondering if Kirby is into free love, if she ever goes without a bra,
if she has shed the sexual inhibitions that shackled girls who grew up in the 1950s. Of course Kirby is a feminist. She has been somewhat promiscuous in the past. Before Officer Scotty Turbo, she had two other lovers. Though after what happened this spring, she has vowed to wait for love before jumping in the sack with someone again. She will never, ever sleep with Evan O'Rourke. But she can have some fun with him, maybe. "Do you smoke grass, Evan?" she asks. He looks startled, and Kirby wonders if she misread him. Maybe he'll ask Kirby to leave the house before she unpacks a single miniskirt. She will have to ask Rajani for a place to stay after all. Or she will be forced to spend the summer on Nantucket with Exalta, Kate, and Jesse. Unthinkable. When will she learn to keep her mouth shut? Suddenly, Evan breaks out into a lopsided grin. "On occasion," he says, "though technically smoking in the house is forbidden. Also forbidden are alcohol consumption and guests of the opposite sex." "All of that forbidden?" Kirby asks. No wonder David wrote the check so readily. He must have confirmed this place was a convent. "Really, Evan?" She reaches out to touch Evan's hand, which is as pale as pudding. He jumps, and Kirby pulls back. The last thing she wants is to give poor Evan an erection. "Well, technically," Evan says. "What about music?" Kirby asks. "Is music allowed?" "As long as it's not too loud," Evan says. Kirby purses her lips. She'll break Evan in slowly. She unzips her duffel. "I brought only 6 records," she says. It took Kirby hours to choose the 6, which were all that would fit in her bag. In the end, she decided it was most important to have albums for different moods. Jubilance, anger, personal and political. Hope, personal and political. Heartbreak, mellow introspection, and rainy day / Sunday. Optimistic, she pulls out the 2nd. "How do you feel about Steppenwolf?" A few minutes later, Kirby and Evan O'Rourke are on the roof, lying back and propping themselves up on their elbows, stoned out of their minds. John Kay wails in the background. The roof has a tremendous view of Circuit Avenue, Ocean Park, Vineyard Sound. Evan is far more tolerable to Kirby in her present condition. "I've got a job cleaning rooms at the Shiretown Inn," Kirby says. "That's in Edgartown," Evan says. "Do you have a car?"
"No car," Kirby says.
"A bike?"
"No bike," Kirby says. "And no money to buy a bike, even secondhand."
"So how will you go back and forth to Edgartown?" Evan asks.
"I thought maybe I'd walk," Kirby says.
Evan breaks out in a fit of giggles. If Kirby closed her eyes, she would swear he was a 10-year-old girl. "It's too far to walk," Evan says. "3 miles at least."
3 miles isn't that far," Kirby says, though her heart sinks. She's used to Nantucket, where there is only one town. On Martha's Vineyard, there are 6 towns, some of them quite distant from here. She vaguely knew this, but she hadn't given any thought to the reality of her commute. "What will I do?"
"You'll have to hitchhike," Evan says. "Pretty girl like you shouldn't have any trouble."
The next morning finds Kirby up early and one of the first women at breakfast, which is porridge with fresh blueberries, brown sugar, and milk, as well as a platter of brown bread with butter and apricot preserves. Kirby isn't usually a breakfast person, and she certainly isn't a porridge and brown bread person, but she decides that, since the food is free, she will eat, and eat lavishly. When all of the women are assembled around the table, Kirby sees that she chose a good seat. The only person who looks even remotely promising is the woman sitting next to her. She's plump with a pretty face, big blue eyes, long dark hair, rosy lips, and a cheerful attitude.
"Patricia O'Callaghan,"
she says, offering a hand. Call me Patty.
Catherine Foley, Kirby says. Call me Kirby.
You took the attic room? Patty asks.
Yes, I love it, Kirby says.
A thin-lipped girl across the table snorts. It's hot, she says, and there's a mouse.
I kept the fan on, Kirby says, and I'm not scared of anything.
So there, Barb, Patty says.
Barb scowls at Kirby, and Kirby regrets her display of bravado. The fact is, she is scared of certain things, hitchhiking for one, and the prospect of unemployment for another. She lied to her parents, Dr. Frazier, and Evan O'Rourke when she said she had a job. The woman she'd spoken to at the Shiretown Inn had said only that they had openings for chambermaids. She couldn't offer Kirby a job without an in-person interview. During breakfast, Patty talks about herself. She's the youngest of 9 children. Her parents live in South Boston, and she came to the Vineyard because her brother Tommy is the manager of the Strand Movie Theater, and he got Patty a job working the ticket window for matinees and some evening shows. Patty wants to be an actress. She applied to the Lee Strasberg School for Acting in New York, but was rejected, and she doesn't have the money to attend Yale. She figures if she sees as many movies as possible, she might learn by osmosis. Plus, she gets free popcorn.
My brother lives with 2 other guys out in Chilmark, Patty says. I'll introduce you.
Do you have a car? Kirby asks hopefully.
Bike, Patty says. She casts a longing look at the butter and apricot preserves. My goal is to lose 25 pounds this summer. After breakfast, Patty shows Kirby her room. She's on the first floor to the left of the front entrance, which is good, she says, because it makes it easy to sneak out after curfew. And she has to share the downstairs bathroom with only one other person, Barb, who traded the attic for the broom closet. Barb is odious, Patty confides. She's always sullen, and she was judgmental when Patty slept through church this past Sunday.
Church? Kirby says. No one goes to church in the summertime.
You must be Episcopalian, Patty says.
Guilty as charged, Kirby says.
The Episcopal Church on Nantucket, St. Paul's, is located on Fair Street, a scant block and a half from Exalta's house. But she and the family normally go only once a summer, usually for an evensong service. Although they might attend more often this year, with Tiger overseas. Kirby wonders if she should go to Mass with Patty so she can light a candle for her brother.
The other 3 girls live on the second floor, and they're Irish, from County Cork. I call them the M's, for Miranda, Maureen, and Michaela. They're square. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't sleep around.
Kirby decides then and there that she loves Patty.
How dull, she says.
On Patty's advice, Kirby dresses in a knee-length skirt and a proper blouse for her interview at the Shiretown Inn. She brushes her hair, collects it in a ponytail, then coils the ponytail into a bun. Then she walks to Seaview Avenue and sticks out her thumb. A bunch of vehicles pass her by, including a laundry service truck and an open-top Jeep filled with college boys. One of the boys whistles, and another one holds up 2 fingers and a peace sign. But the Jeep doesn't slow down, and there's no room for Kirby anyway. Kirby walks along the water. It's serene and seems completely safe, but still she wonders what her mother and, God forbid, her grandmother would think if they saw her hitchhiking. They would think she had a death wish. Why else would she get into a car with a complete stranger? Anything could happen. Abduction, dismemberment, rape, murder. A cherry red Chevy Corvair slows down, and Kirby sees that the driver is black. She knows this shouldn't influence her decision about whether or not to accept the ride. How can she claim to be a progressive if she displays the very prejudice she's seeking to change? The car stops, and a young man cranks down the window. He's good-looking, she notes. He wears a spotless white T-shirt and Ray-Ban Wayfarers.
Where are you headed?
he asks. Edgartown, she says. The Shiretown Inn?
Know it well, he says. Hop in.
Kirby hesitates, but only for a second. This is how hitchhiking works, right? When someone offers you a ride, you take it. Kirby hurries around and hops in the passenger side. The car is clean. There's no trash, no dust, and no sand. Kirby feels a pang for the International Harvester Scout that she drives on Nantucket. She was almost proud of how, by Labor Day weekend, the Scout contained the souvenirs of a summer well spent. Her Bing pintail surfboard, a handful of bikini bottoms, sand dollars and slipper shells, wadded up takeout wrappers from the Seagull in Matticat, half a dozen damp beach towels, a few crushed Schlitz cans, the random horseshoe crab carapace, a swollen, rippled paperback of Valley of the Dolls, and approximately half a ton of sand. This car looks like it just came from the dealer. I'm going to a job interview, she says.
Nice, he says. Did you just arrive for the summer?
Yesterday, Kirby says. I go to Simmons in Boston. The guy laughs.
I go to Harvard, he says, in Cambridge.
Wait a minute, Kirby says. Are you Darren?
I am, he says.
He shifts his Ray-Ban Wayfarers to the top of his head, then breaks into a truly radiant smile and snaps his fingers a few times.
You must be Rajani's friend. Is it Kathy? Kitty?
Kirby, she says. My real name is Catherine, but everyone calls me Kirby.
Didn't Rajani tell me your family has a house on Nantucket? Darren asks.
Afraid so, Kirby says.
So why the switch? Darren asks. Don't get me wrong. We'll take as many pretty girls as we can get on the vineyard. But I thought Nantucketers kept to their own island.
I needed a change, Kirby says. She gazes out the window as they cross a wooden bridge. To the right is a large, placid pond edged with reeds. I had a trying year. She closes her eyes and shakes her head. She had not meant to say that. My brother was deployed to Vietnam in May.
Man, Darren says, that sucks.
I tried to convince him to go to Canada, but he said Canada was for people who were afraid of getting shot at. He agrees the war is wrong.
Really wrong, Darren says.
But he felt a sense of duty. Our father, Kirby swallows, was in Korea. He was a big hero, I guess. I don't know. He died a few months after he got home, so I never really knew him, but, I mean, we'd always been taught he was a war hero. I think Tiger took that legacy pretty seriously.
I can see that, Darren says. I have friends from Boston Latin who were drafted, and then my freshman year roommate at Harvard enlisted. He was killed in the Battle of Dok To.
I heard about that one on the news, Kirby says. I'm sorry. That's one of the reasons I'm against the war. Westmoreland sent American soldiers in to take that hill at any cost, and then a couple weeks later, the army abandoned it.
People say Abrams is better, Darren says. I'm sure your brother will be fine.
He has to be fine, Kirby says. That was what she told Tiger before he left. He had to come back alive. Other families might be strong enough to bear the loss of their sons and brothers, but the Foley Levins weren't. They just weren't. Or maybe it was only Kirby who wouldn't be able to survive. She had been pretty messed up in her own life when Tiger left. Her heartbreak over Scotty had been at its most acute. She had, in fact, told Tiger that she would move to Canada with him. They could get a flat in Montreal, learn to speak French, learn to like hockey. They would emigrate and never look back. She desperately needs to change the subject. What do you do for work?
I'm a lifeguard at Inkwell Beach, Darren says. I was headed there when I saw you.
I took you out of your way, Kirby says. I'm so sorry, but thank you. This would have been one heck of a walk. They pass a sign announcing that they're entering Edgartown. and Kirby takes in the leafy streets lined with charming white clapboard homes. It's even more picturesque than downtown Nantucket, which Kirby didn't think was possible. They cruise by the Wailing Church, an exquisite pocket garden with stone benches in the shade, a white-columned building called Preservation Hall.
"I don't have to be at work until 10, Darren says. "I just like to get there early. Lead by example, you know?"
He grins, and Kirby can't help herself. She practically swoons. Darren is so good-looking and so cool. Kirby has never had a black friend before, though she's on good terms with the black women at Simmons, especially Tracy from her English class, who introduced her to the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks. Rajani is Indian, and she and Kirby have spent countless hours discussing racially charged issues, so Kirby feels like she's had her eyes opened. She wants nothing more than to live in a country that's free from prejudice. She wonders what it would be like to date Darren. Of course, he isn't asking her out. He's just giving her a ride. Darren drops Kirby off in front of the Shiretown Inn just as a woman with bright red hair wearing a green dress is walking up the steps. Darren calls out, "Hey, Mrs. Benny!" The red-haired woman holds a hand over her eyes to shade them as Kirby climbs out of the car, careful to gather her skirt around her legs. Mrs. Benny is the woman she spoke to on the phone, and Kirby wonders how it will look, her climbing out of Darren's car. "Hey there, Darren," Mrs. Benny says. "Please tell your parents how much I enjoyed myself the other night. There's nothing like steamers at the Fraser House."
"Will do,"
Darren says. Mrs. Benny waves and disappears inside. "Thanks for the ride," Kirby says. "You're a lifesaver."
"Good luck with your interview," Darren says. "Where are you living?"
Kirby tells him the address.
"Miss O'Rourke's house," Darren says.
"You know it?"
"The prettiest girls live there each summer," Darren says, "and I can see this year is no exception."
"Aw, thanks," Kirby says. She executes a quick curtsy.
"Just watch out for Evan," Darren says.
"I can handle the likes of Evan," Kirby says. "Putty in my hands."
"I'm sure he is," Darren says. "So, hey, why don't you swing by Inkwell Beach sometime? I'm always there, and it's an easy walk from your house."
"Okay," Kirby says. "I'll do that."
"I mean it," Darren says. "Come by."
Kirby's heart somersaults. "I mean it," she says. "I will." Darren waves and drives off, and Kirby stands on the sidewalk staring at the car until it disappears from view. Hitchhiking is the best thing she's ever done. It turns out Mrs. Benny is the general manager of the Shiretown Inn. She invites Kirby into a small office behind the front desk.
"How do you know Darren?" Mrs. Benny asks.
Kirby nearly says she just met him hitchhiking, but she worries how that will make her sound.
"From school," she says.
Mrs. Benny looks at Kirby's resume, which is on the desk before her.
"But you go to Simmons," she says. "That's a girls' school."
"Women's school," Kirby thinks.
"I met him through a friend of mine at Simmons," Kirby says. "She and Darren grew up here together in the summers."
"Well, you know, Darren's family has lived here forever," Mrs. Benny says. "I've known that boy since he was an itty-bitty baby." Kirby loves hearing this. Martha's Vineyard is a place where racial harmony exists. Mrs. Benny points to a handwritten note in the margin of Kirby's resume. Kirby spent hours on her sister's Underwood typing and retyping until the thing was perfect, and yet someone has scribbled all over it.
"It says here that you're interested in a chambermaid position," Mrs. Benny says. "But I'm sorry to say, those jobs have all been taken. The Irish girls, you know, they get here in May."
Kirby's spirits fall. The Irish girls, like Miranda, Maureen, and Michaela on the second floor, arrived in May and snapped up all the jobs. If the cleaning jobs are gone, what will be left for her? Pumping gas? Bagging groceries?
I wanted to get here earlier, Kirby says, but I had to finish up the semester.
Mrs. Benny raises her head and seems to see Kirby for the first time.
You're a pretty girl, she says. And you have 3 years of college.
She leans over so that Kirby has a view of her matronly cleavage. How would you feel about a position on the front desk?
It's too good to be true.
Speechless, Kirby nods.
I've just had to fire a girl, Mrs. Benny says, for being indiscreet.
Kirby knows not to ask, but she naturally wonders, what did this girl do?
Mrs. Benny seems to read Kirby's mind. We had a guest staying with us, a gentleman guest, and Veronica gave this gentleman's wife a key to his room without checking with him or with me. It led to a very unfortunate situation.
Gentleman guest caught with a co-ed, Kirby guesses. Or his secretary. Or someone else's wife. She pushes away thoughts of Scotty Turbo.
Before you accept, I need to make certain aspects of the job clear. You are to be on time. You are to be neatly dressed with your hair coiffed. No pants or culottes. No bare arms. We have distinguished guests at this inn, Wall Street types, business executives. In fact, I just booked a room for Senator Edward Kennedy. He's coming to stay with us next month.
Teddy Kennedy. Kirby can't believe it.
Mrs. Benny continues, Our priority here at the inn is our guests' comfort and their privacy. Is that clear?
Crystal, Kirby says. She's glad she tied her hair back for this interview, though she worries about a wardrobe. She'll have to see if the Vineyard has a store like Butner's where she can buy some appropriate outfits. Teddy Kennedy. She can't wait to tell Rogeny about that. Except, no, she has to be discreet.
The shift that's available is 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Is that going to be a problem?
It takes Kirby a moment to process this. 11 at night until 7 in the morning. Mrs. Benny is offering her the graveyard shift. Is that going to be a problem?
Kirby quickly calculates. She will get back to Narragansett Avenue in time to eat breakfast with the girls, and then she'll go to sleep. If she sleeps from 8 to 2, she'll still have afternoons to go to the beach and her evenings free. It's not optimal, but she knows better than to turn this offer down.
Weekends off? She asks hopefully.
Mondays and Tuesdays off, Mrs. Benny says. You'll leave here Monday morning at 7 and return Wednesday night at 11. The job pays $90 a week.
$90 a week?
Kirby is appalled at herself for bending to the power of the American dollar, but there's no denying its allure. She has to give up her weekends. But considering her troubled past, this might not be a bad thing. She has to prove herself worthy. She has to develop a work ethic. Mrs. Benny is offering Kirby a chance to demonstrate that she's a responsible adult. Also, with this schedule, she'll avoid the logjam for the second floor bathroom, and her parents will have no reason to complain. Kirby is going to be a front desk clerk.
I'll take it, she says.
Those were the days. She has made a deal with the devil. She had no choice. Kate is no stranger to military sacrifice. Wilder died when he was back home on American soil, but Kate knows he never returned from Korea. Not really. However, sending a son into battle is different, and Vietnam is a different war. The jungle is nearly impenetrable, the heat murderous, the insects predatory, the swamps thick and green with murk. It's hard enough to battle the country itself, never mind the ruthlessly immoral Viet Cong. They set savage booby traps, punji sticks, snake pits, grenades in a can. Kate and David had been quietly anti-war since 1965. A paralegal from David's firm enlisted, and this young man, 22 years old, was killed in the Battle of Ia Drang after only a week in country.
Kate had feared that Tiger would enlist as soon as he graduated from high school, but he'd half-heartedly enrolled at Framingham State. Now she wishes that he had enlisted. Then, at least, he might have had choices. He might have been able to train for a job that kept him off the front lines. But Tiger took his chances, and now he is a grunt, one of thousands. He is expendable. Kate's only hope for getting Tiger home quickly, possibly as soon as September, rests with Mr. Crimmins. When Kate wrote to Bill Crimmins to let him know that Tiger had been drafted and wouldn't be coming to Nantucket that summer, Bill had written back to say that his brother-in-law had served with Creighton W. Abrams in the Battle of the Bulge, and that he still corresponded with the general weekly about matters both military and personal. Bill said he would ask his brother-in-law to use his influence with the general to get Tiger out. But Bill requested a favor in return. The drama about the television served as a good cover for the drama about the boy. Kate glimpses Pick from her bedroom window as she unpacks her suitcase. He's getting on his bicycle. Kate notes the shape of his shoulders and the golden glint of his hair. She finds she's trembling. Kate thought Exalta would prove to be an obstacle to the plan, but that wasn't the case. Kate had explained the situation to her a few weeks ago. Mr. Crimmins had discovered that Lorraine had a son out in California. Lorraine, now called Lavender, had vanished, and Mr. Crimmins had gone out to fetch the child, but he had no room in his efficiency on Pine Street to house the boy, and Exalta had easily been led to the solution. Bill Crimmins and his grandson would both live in Little Fair. "It'll be nice for us to have a man around," Exalta said. Kate didn't bother pointing out that David would be coming every weekend. She was simply relieved that Exalta didn't oppose this new arrangement. In fact, Exalta proceeded to act as though inviting Bill Crimmins and his grandson to stay in Little Fair had been her idea. "Everything will be okay," Kate tells herself. Bill Crimmins wrote to his brother-in-law last week, just before he and the boy moved in, and he would likely hear back this week or next. Tiger would be plucked from danger as suddenly as he had been dropped into it. He would come home. Following the boy out of Little Fair is someone else, a young woman. It's Jessie, Kate realizes. The way Jessie stands as she talks to the boy, with her hand on her waist and her hip cocked, looks very mature. Well, Kate thinks, she is 13. Today. Poor sweet Jessie has had to sacrifice her birthday to the task of arriving and settling in. Kate is too addled to do anything more than take everyone to Susie's for dinner. And that isn't a birthday ritual, but a first night on Nantucket ritual. However, she supposes they can stop at the Island Dairy Bar on the way home for a sundae. It's a pathetic effort to celebrate the beginning of her youngest child's teenage years. Kate decides she'll make it up to Jessie next week, once things have calmed down. They'll have dinner, just the two of them, at the Mad Hatter, Jessie's favorite. Kate shoves her suitcase to the back of the closet the way she always does, an attempt to avoid thinking about the reality that she will have to pack it up again. She then takes stock of the room, her summer bedroom for as long as she has been alive. She lived here as a little girl, back when America was happy and prosperous. She lived here as a teenager during the Depression, when men from around the island would knock on the door to see if Kate's parents needed any work done on the house. It was in this era, Kate recalls, that they hired Bill Crimmins to do odd jobs, and Lorraine, his daughter, to serve as maid and cook. The Crimminses had moved to Nantucket year-round after Bill lost his job at the textile mill up in Lowell, Mass. Bill's wife died when Lorraine was a baby. Kate had lived here as a young wife to Wilder Foley with his manic depressive disorder, his pathological lies, and his undeniable magnetism. She can remember sitting in the window seat waiting for Wilder to come home on one of the many nights he insisted on staying late at Bosun's Locker. She'd lived here as the bereft mother of three fatherless children
during the awful summer of 1953. Lorraine Crimmins had run off to California, and Kate spent the better part of July and August without anyone to mind the children. She cut out paper dolls with Blair and Kirby. She taught Blair to ride a bicycle on Plum Lane. She dug holes in the sand at Steps Beach with Tiger, crying behind her giant sunglasses. Next, she had lived here as the wife of David Levin, the Jewish attorney whom Exalta had never accepted despite the fact that he was a good, kind, stable man, as sane and calm as Wilder had been reckless and unpredictable, willing to take on three children not his own and treat them the same way that he treated his own daughter, Jessica. And now, Kate is 48 years old, an age she only properly feels when she's in a place that holds all of her different lives together, as this room does. On the dresser, there's a photograph of the family taken in the dunes of Steps Beach. Kate and David in the center back row, Blair and Angus on their left, Kirby on their right, and Tiger and Jesse sitting in front. They're all smiling and glowing with their summer coloring, lighter hair, darker skin. Exalta had enjoyed too many Hendrix and tonics that day at lunch and had fallen asleep, missing this excursion to Steps Beach. Kate, frankly, is glad she wasn't there. This is her family. She is the matriarch. She studies her own face and feels heartbroken at her own naive sense of security. "Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end." Tiger's absence is only temporary, Kate tells herself. She will have faith in Bill Crimmins. She will do her best to make the boy feel welcome, and she will be duly rewarded. Mr. Crimmins will find a way to get Tiger home. They will be a family again. Suspicious Minds. In Boston, the temperature hits 80 degrees, and Blair, just entering her third trimester, has outgrown all of her maternity clothes. She has only one dress that still fits. It looks like a yellow circus tent, and yet she has no choice but to wear it every time she leaves the house, which she now does as infrequently as possible. Angus agreed to pay extra to have Savinors deliver the groceries, and he has held his tongue about the skyrocketing electric bill. Blair keeps the air conditioning unit running 24 hours a day. The apartment feels like the North Pole, and still Blair perspires as she sits in front of the television watching That Girl and eating grilled cheese sandwiches, followed by Hunt Snack Pack butterscotch puddings, one after the other. Instead of seeing Angus's acquiescence about the extra expenses as kind, Blair understands them as a manifestation of his guilty conscience. He's unwilling to tell Blair the truth about where he was the day she surprised him at the office. He resolutely maintains he was at a meeting, although the nature of that meeting has changed three times, and he can't explain why his hair was mussed or his jacket misbuttoned. Blair also noted a suspicious phone call. She answered the phone in their apartment, and a woman's cool, melodious voice asked for Mr. Whalen. This when everyone at MIT calls Angus Dr. Whalen or Professor Whalen. Blair acted on her hunch and said, "I'm sorry, he's not home at the moment. Is this Joanne?" The woman hung up. One evening in early June, the phone rings, and Angus answers the kitchen phone at the same time that Blair picks up the extension next to the bed. She's lying there in her underwear beneath one thin sheet, morosely waiting for Angus to warm up a TV dinner and deliver it like room service. "Hello," Angus says. "Whalen residence."
"Mr. Whalen," the silvery voice says. "This is Trixie."
It takes Blair only an instant to realize that Angus doesn't know she's on the line.
"Trixie," Angus says. "Listen, I'm sorry about today. Something came up at work, but I'd like to see you tomorrow."
"That's fine, but I'm going to have to charge you for today."
"Yes," Angus says. "I understand. Of course."
Blair barely manages to stifle a gasp. Angus clears his throat and says,
"Darling, are you on the phone?"
He pauses.
"Blair?"
Blair presses the plastic button to disconnect, then carefully sets the receiver down and lies back in what she hopes is a believable imitation of pregnant slumber. A second later, Angus taps on the door, and Blair smells the commingled scents of Salisbury steak, peas, and apple cobbler.
"Darling?"
Blair keeps her eyes shut. Angus has been seeing a call girl, a prostitute. On the one hand, this is a relief because it's not Joanne of the turquoise eyeshadow and Pat the Bunny, and it eliminates Blair's other suspicion that Angus is involved romantically with one of the male students at the university. On the other hand, the idea of Angus with a prostitute is sickening. It's so seedy, so beneath him. He's paying for sex. It's possible he's been paying for sex all along. This would explain how he became so skilled in the bedroom. But what about disease? Does Angus really have so little regard for Blair and for their unborn baby? Trixie, Blair thinks. It's gratifying to have a name to pin on her rival. The prostitute's name is Trixie. As Blair waits for the next mysterious phone call, the days grow hotter. Kirby swings by the apartment to say goodbye. She's spending the summer on Martha's Vineyard instead of Nantucket, something Blair doesn't quite understand. "I need to get Mom's foot off my neck," Kirby says. "It's time for me to grow up." This, Blair wholeheartedly agrees with. Kirby lacks discipline and seems content to go whichever way the wind blows her. Blair decides not to tell Kirby that being a grown-up is overrated. "You're working in housekeeping?" Blair says. "Was that the best job you could find?"
"At least I have a job," Kirby says.
She rakes her eyes across Blair's bed, food wrappers, empty pudding cups, the TV guide, and a copy of The Love Machine by Jacqueline Suzanne, which is what passes for literature these days. Blair nearly snaps back, but she can see that her situation is pathetic, and she doesn't have the energy to match wits with her sister. Her brain has turned to consommé. The role reversal is disheartening. Back in the dark days when Blair and Kirby's father died, Blair was 8, Kirby 5, Kirby used to climb, whimpering, into Blair's bed. She was old enough to know something was very wrong, but not old enough to be told exactly what, and Kate had been focused on caring for Tiger, who was only 3 and still a handful. Blair remembers someone, her grandmother maybe, or Janie Beckett, telling Blair that Kirby was lucky to have her as an older sister. She could serve as a role model. Blair had taken this very seriously. Her entire life has been a masterclass in how to lead by example. But now, Kirby must be looking at Blair and thinking, "I do not want to end up that way." "I shouldn't have quit my job," Blair says. "I should have spent the past year teaching, but Angus wanted me home."
"Why didn't you stand up for yourself?" Kirby asks.
"You know what Betty Friedan would say." "Betty Friedan isn't married to an astronaut." Blair nearly laughs because that statement is so absurd, and no doubt Kirby's next point will be that Blair isn't married to an astronaut either. Not really. "And now I'm good and stuck, aren't I? Barefoot and pregnant. I'm bored out of my mind. I'm so bored that my imagination comes up with all of these conspiracy theories."
"Have you figured out who killed the Kennedys?" Kirby asks.
Blair can't bring herself to smile. She longs to tell her sister about Angus and Trixie, but she doesn't want to admit to another failure. Not only is Blair not working, but the husband she quit her job for is cheating on her. "Enjoy your time on the vineyard," Blair says. "Cleaning is honest work. I'm proud of you." "Aw, Blair," Kirby says. She puts her hand on Blair's belly, and the baby kicks.
That's your Aunt Kirby,
Blair says.
Hey, kid, Kirby says. Get ready for 1969. I have some protest songs to teach you.
The next day, Kate drops in to say goodbye before she leaves for Nantucket with Jesse and Exalta.
Dad will be home in case of emergency, Kate tells Blair. She sets down an assortment of magazines, Good Housekeeping, Ladies' Home Journal, Woman's Weekly. Nothing with any real news. Blair knows her mother wants to keep her from being shocked or upset, but Blair doesn't want to read 10 Cold Suppers for Summer or Weekend Embroidery Projects. She needs a far less wholesome magazine with articles like What to Do When Your Husband is Seeing a Prostitute. She needs Cosmopolitan.
And I'll be back on the 1st of August, like we discussed, so I can be with you for the birth.
I'm leaving Angus, Blair says.
Kate doesn't even blink.
I know he's been working hard, sweetheart. But the moon landing...
Damn the moon landing, Blair says.
Liftoff for Apollo 11 is scheduled for July 16th, although any one of 1,000 things could delay it, pushing it back a few weeks to Blair's due date. At this point, she hopes Angus is in Houston when the baby comes. She doesn't want him anywhere near her.
He's having an affair with some woman named Trixie.
She can't bear to admit the prostitute part to Kate, but perhaps the name Trixie makes that obvious.
Really?
Kate asks. She sounds skeptical.
Are you sure?
It's common, you know, to imagine he's being unfaithful because you're feeling undesirable.
This isn't a figment of my imagination, Mother, Blair says. She called here. I heard her voice.
Well, I'm sure Angus will come to his senses once the baby is born, Kate says. Blair closes her eyes and sees red, and all she can imagine is her blood pressure spiking to such an alarming level that the baby shoots right out of her. She needs to calm down. She opens her nightstand drawer, pulls out a pack of Kents, and lights one up.
So you suggest I just wait for this to end on its own?
You suggest I tolerate this?
You're 7 months pregnant, sweetheart, Kate says. You can't leave, and you can't get divorced, and you can't confront Angus because the emotional turmoil is bad for the baby.
Blair should never have told her mother. She should have just swallowed her pride and confided in Kirby. Kirby would never advise Blair to stay with a cheating husband.
That's such an old-fashioned view, Mother, Blair declares.
What would Betty Friedan say?
Who?
Kate says. Blair shakes her head and collects herself.
I thought maybe I could move into Nani's house, she says, since she's away.
Kate laughs.
The house is just sitting there, empty, Blair says.
Her grandmother's townhouse in Beacon Hill is large, cool, and gracious, with clocks that chime and hand-knotted silk rugs that feel like heaven under bare feet. The bed in the guest room is a king, and the windows look out over the back courtyard, where there's a tall, wrought-iron fountain that makes a soothing, gurgling sound. It wouldn't be as good as escaping to the islands, but it would be better than staying here on Calm Ave.
And empty it will remain, Kate says. I'm sorry, sweet pea. You're 24 years old, a grown woman, married and pregnant. And you need to act like an adult and not a child who runs away from her problems. Angus has a remarkable career and provides very well for you. If he is having a dalliance with this Trixie, it's probably because he's under so much pressure. Really, you might think to be grateful.
Grateful? Blair says.
Grateful, Mother?
He's never home. He works all the time, and on the rare occasions he does make an appearance.
She pauses, unsure how much more she wants her mother to know. Kate looks at her expectantly.
He's moody, unpredictable. Sometimes he seems like a completely different person than the man I married.
Oh, honey. Kate seems to soften a bit. She reaches over to brush a stray hair from Blair's forehead, and Blair briefly leans into the cooling comfort of her mother's palm, remembering how she used to pretend she felt feverish just so that her mother would rest that soft and steady hand against her face.
The memory ends when Kate stands up briskly and leaves the bedroom. She returns a moment later with a glass of brown liquid over ice. At first, Blair thinks it's iced tea, but when she smells it, she's happy to find it's scotch.
"Isn't your doctor's appointment tomorrow?" Kate asks.
"The appointment with Dr. Sayer, yes." The deplorable Dr. Sayer with the grotesque overgrown beard who feels Blair up with cold hands while his googly eyes swim behind his glasses.
"Yes," Blair says.
She stubs out her cigarette in the ashtray by the bed and takes a sip of scotch. Immediately she relaxes.
"At 10. Is Angus going with you?"
"He's supposed to," Blair says,
"but he may have forgotten and planned a rendezvous with Trixie."
Kate laughs and says, "It's best to keep a sense of humor about it.
Let me know how it goes. We should be on Nantucket by 4 in the afternoon tomorrow. Love you, sweet pea. Be well."
Kate leans over to kiss Blair on the forehead and give her shoulder a squeeze, and for one instant, Blair feels okay.
"Bye," Blair says.
She can't believe her mother is being so nonchalant about the news. Blair should have disclosed the prostitute part. Maybe then Kate would have been appropriately aghast. Her mother grew up in a time when young women were expected to just put up with unfaithful husbands. But now it's 1969, and Blair won't stand for it. If moving into Nonnie's isn't an option, then Blair will just go to Nantucket for the summer. She'll have the baby on the island, at the cottage hospital. But Blair won't last 2 hours in the car and 2 hours on a ferry. Merely driving up the cobblestones of Main Street might send her into premature labor. She's trapped. Angus remembers about Blair's doctor's appointment the next day, which is a relief to Blair because the notion of going anywhere alone in her condition is daunting. Ruth, the office receptionist, takes one look at Blair and Angus and leads them right back to the office where Dr. Sayer is sitting at the desk, smoking. Blair can't tell if Ruth is alarmed by her size or if she's impressed that Dr. Whalen has chosen to accompany his wife to the appointment when he's such a busy man working on a matter that's so important to the nation's pride. Maybe it's a little of both. There is no mistaking Dr. Sayer's reaction, however. When he sees Angus, he jumps to his feet and starts pumping Angus's hand. There follows a long conversation about the moon launch and the merits of various astronauts. Angus wholly defends Armstrong and Aldrin, but Dr. Sayer feels Jim Lovell should be included. And then Angus shifts into technical talk about thrust